You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 76, Leviticus 16. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Very good. Very good.
Good. Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
We did. We had a couple families over and some little kids. You know, all my kids were there, but they're not little anymore. So, yeah, we had a good time.
Good. And you do the traditional turkey and stuffing and all that stuff?
Yep. Yep, even the green bean casserole thing. So it was real traditional.
Now, do you actually help cook, prepare?
Oh, I don't cook. I probably did dishes half a dozen times.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, our dishwasher decided it was going to break. You know, so that was great.
Right. So yeah, I hear that. Did you watch football? Did you watch the Packers?
Unfortunately, I watched the Packers lay an egg. You know, what can I say?
No, well, I won't rub it in too much because. Romo broke his collarbone again, so I can't say too much. So
maybe the Packers and Cowboys should just play each other the rest of the way, and they might each win a couple games. So
well, no, because the refs will just say Dez didn't catch any balls, and Packers will just win. So
right,
it doesn't matter.
Groundhog Day there.
Right. Well, Mike, we decided to include Leviticus 15 back in the past episode, so I was wondering if you could just summarize Leviticus 15 for us real quick. And I had a particular question on why does Leviticus specify for men semen?
Well, again, going back to the episode, and the reason we sort of folded Leviticus 15 back into that episode is because I actually talked quite a bit about what was going on in chapter 15 in conjunction with the earlier episode, which covered 12 through 14. But now, of course, we're going to label it 12 through 15. And again, going back to the, you know, the seminal discharges, you know, we talked about how the loss of, you know, life-giving fluids, that which, you know, God has given to us to, you know, create life, and he is the source of life. So the diminishment of that, I think, is the logic behind the status of impurity there. Again, to remind, you know, people that they are lesser, they are not fit for sacred space, again, because of this power, if you will, this ability, you know, given by the life giver has been diminished. So that gets folded into it. And we mentioned real briefly in that last episode, in a pre-scientific culture, you know, the equivalent of that for the female, for a woman, was also considered to be part of the procreative process, you know, part of how children were conceived. And so that's part of the logic too. But you have other discharges as well that would be viewed as abnormalities, especially when it comes to the female side. And if you'll notice back in Leviticus 15, it was associated with the same kind of language for that was associated with menstruation. So again, there the issue is blood, you know, the loss of blood and that sort of thing. So, you know, people can pick up a little bit of that, you know, if they go back to chapter 15 and give that a listen. But we dipped into it so many times in the previous episode that I really can't, you know, spend a whole episode on chapter 15 without it being quite repetitive. So that, hence we're moving on to chapter 16. Well, let's jump in here to 16. You know, in many ways, this is the episode that people have been sort of looking for, because Leviticus 16 is another one of these chapters that if you're familiar with anything in Leviticus, it's probably this chapter. I mean, we had the dietary laws. People are familiar with those. But, you know, this one probably trumps even those, because it's, you know, the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, which is still practiced in some form in Judaism today. And, of course, the biblical form of it was altered even in biblical times, because of the loss of the temple. So, you know, we're more familiar with this because it's still current, actually. So just generally, again, the general rationale as we go through Leviticus 16, and we'll basically go through most of the chapter is concerned with the removal, and not just the removal, but the destruction of impurity. So a couple of things to note in that regard. And you need to, as you listen to this, you need to be focused on impurity, because, again, we take this language, Day of Atonement, and because of the New Testament, or because of the way we've been taught about the Old Testament, probably both, we look at this terminology and associate it with forgiveness of sins, you know, that kind of thing. That is not the way it's cast in Leviticus 16, even though in the absence of the temple and later Judaism, that sort of became the focus because you don't have a temple. So you can't really talk about impurity, you know, cleansing the sanctuary. Because you'll notice as we go through Leviticus 16 that the blood of the sacrificed goat and the quote-unquote sin offerings, which again, hearkening back to Leviticus 4, are actually purification offerings or decontamination offerings. The blood of those sacrifices is used to purify the sanctuary, you know, the tabernacle, the holy place. It is not applied to people. It's not applied to humans. And so right away you have a disconnect again with the New Testament conception of atonement and Jesus and whatnot. So let's try to keep impurity in our minds as we go through the chapter here. And second thought, the goat for Azazel. And if that's an unfamiliar phrase to listeners, you know, I'll catch you up when we hit that point in the passage. But the goat for Azazel, often translated scapegoat, again, rather unfortunately, and I would say inaccurately, gets driven into the wilderness. So this is also a ritual of riddance, you know, getting rid of something. So you have removal of impurity, you have destruction of impurity in the sense that it is cast out of the community. Impurity is cast out of the community, which is another way of saying it's driven away from sacred space. So again, the emphasis is on protecting sacred space. And really, I mean, you could summarize Leviticus 16 with a very modern term. That is, Leviticus 16 is essentially a reset button. You're hitting reset because it takes the sanctuary, it takes the holy instruments, the vessels associated with service in the sanctuary, in the holy place, and even the people. It restores, and that includes the priesthood, obviously, but it restores everything and everyone to that state at which everything and everyone was back in Leviticus 8, when the tabernacle and the priesthood and everything was sanctified for the first time so that it could be used to, you know, accomplish what needed to be accomplished in the ritual system of sacrifices and offerings. So it's essentially a reset button. Again, that might be helpful to think of it that way. So resetting the whole system so that we can sort of start over now once a year. And everything is, you know, that was in a state of impurity is now taken care of. And again, we're set to go again. Now, in regard to a few more thoughts here before we actually jump into the first verse here, in regard to the removal of impurity and again, the sacred space idea, the rationale also in part helps us to understand, you know, what's going on in the mind of the Israelite in the sense that if we don't do this, if we don't hit the reset button, if we don't make absolutely sure at least once a year that everything is restored to the way it could be, that nothing has been omitted by our own ignorance or our own oversight, that here's a ceremony that gives us the opportunity to just start over again. If we don't do this, there's a threat that God could withdraw again from the sanctuary because it's defiled, because something is being perpetually overlooked. And that, of course, means the alienation of God's presence from the community. So the sanctuary, the picture is the sanctuary is under constant threat of impurity, both from the priesthood, again, the people who functioned within it, who had jobs to do there, anyone, you know, who happened to be rendered impure due to some, again, oversight on their own part, some negligence, because ritual impurities were considered contagious. And there were certain things we've talked about already in Leviticus that if you overlooked your need to be restored to ritual purity and you interacted with someone else, then they became impure and so on and so on and so on. So the reset button was really important. I want to share a quote from Levine. Lastly, before we jump into this, I mentioned a few minutes ago that you know, this is still current, which is why it's familiar. It had to be modified in the absence of a temple. But I came across a quote from Levine that I think is interesting. And again, yet something to just store away in our heads as we jump into the first verse. He writes this. He says, "The ancient view of Yom Kippur is somewhat different from that which came to predominate in later Judaism." So again, the biblical view is a little bit different than what happens later on in Judaism, especially in the centuries following the destruction of the Second Temple of Jerusalem in 70 CE or 70 AD. Atonement for the sins of the people eventually replaced the purification of the sanctuary as the central theme of Yom Kippur. And that was pragmatic. Now, this is me talking now. That was pragmatic because we don't have a temple, so we can't talk about purifying the sacred space anymore. So this day was observed, but it eventually, because all that's left is the people, the emphasis of the ceremony and of the day you know, whatever ceremonial acts are enacted by rabbis, you know, on this day, that the focus became the people, the purification of the people, the atonement for the sins of the people. And that is not how it's described in Leviticus 16, actually, because the blood is never applied to people. It's only applied to the sanctuary, as we'll see. Now, in verse 30, okay, we're back to Levine now. Levine comments that in verse 30, and I'll paraphrase a little bit for the sake of time, there was a sense that while we're purifying the sanctuary, that the people were also reset as well. So this idea that was current in later Judaism is sort of resident and present in Leviticus 16, that sort of the little seed thought, the kernel of it is present in Leviticus 16. But the emphasis in Leviticus 16 is very obviously the sanctuary itself. So in the absence of the sanctuary, this is really the only part of the chapter that can really get meaningful attention in later Judaism. So you only actually have, and Levine points this out in his commentary when he, you know, in relation to this quote, there's only a couple of times when the blood generally of any sacrifice is applied to the people, to the congregation, as opposed to the high priest, you know, the thumb and the earlobe, you know, because the high priest represents the people. There's only a couple of times when blood of a sacrifice is actually applied corporately to the people in a sacrificial act. And that's Exodus 19, which is before, you know, God comes in as a theophany, in a theophanic appearance there at Mount Sinai before the covenant ceremony to embrace the law that God is about to give. When all that was enacted, there's a ceremony again that involves blood being put upon the people at large. And then in Exodus 24, when the Sinai covenant is actually enacted, these are the only places you see this sort of thing happen again corporately. It does not happen in Leviticus 16, but yet the idea that the people are sort of subsumed within the reset button is actually there. So let's jump into Leviticus 16. We'll start with the first few verses. And I'm reading from the ESV again. And we've seen this passage before, so I won't say too much about it. But the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron. Remember, that was back in Leviticus 10. When they drew near before the Lord and died. Verse 2. And the Lord said to Moses, "Tell Aaron, your brother, not to come at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat that is on the ark, so that he may not die. For I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat. But in this way, Aaron shall come into the holy place." And then we get the instructions for the Day of Atonement. So note the phrase again, the reference is back to the death of the sons of Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, which is Leviticus 10. We spent a whole episode on that. And this language here, we said, connects or at least informs us to help understand what likely happened in Leviticus 10, that they had penetrated inside the holy place, you know, to the point of the veil, and only the high priest was supposed to do that. So that was apparently, it had a lot to do with why they were struck down. And so God says in this chapter, hey, tell Aaron, he says to Moses, tell Aaron, your brother, he's not allowed in here just any time, into the holy place inside the veil. You're just not allowed to do this. Only once a year. And verse 3, now let me describe for you, God says, the way Aaron shall enter this place, and of course, when. So that's sort of the lead off. Notice as well in verse 2, it's kind of an interesting phrase. God says, "For I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat." Now the word appear here is ra'ah in Hebrew, and it is the same term used for visible appearance elsewhere when we have like the word of the Lord or Yahweh appearing in human form. For instance, this is the word in Genesis 12:7, when Yahweh, you know, the word of the Lord comes to Abram, Yahweh comes to Abram. Parallel, of course, is chapter 15. 17:1, 18:1, that's the when Yahweh shows up with two angels, again appearing as men, and they have a meal. This is the same term there. It's also used of the Malach Adonai, the Malach Yahweh, the angel of Yahweh. In Exodus 3, the burning bush incident. Exodus, you know, we have Judges 6 with Gideon. Judges 13 with Samson's parents. Again, so it's very possible here that what you have here is that on this one day of the year, Aaron, the high priest, would go in, or whoever was the high priest when they were doing this, inside the veil and see God in human form on the mercy seat, you know, with his feet resting on the ark. The ark is referred to as the footstool in other passages. So apparently Aaron, or the high priest, again, whoever was the high priest, this is the time of year that they might actually see a theophany. They might actually see a visible appearance of the God of Israel in this place on this occasion. Again, because he appears in the cloud. It doesn't say he appears as the cloud. God says, I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat. Again, just a little side note there for people who've read The Unseen Realm. Again, I don't get into that in the book. That's the specific passage, but there you go. We have another instance of this kind of vocabulary here in Leviticus 16. So starting again in verse 3, God says, but in this way, Aaron shall come to the holy place. Here are the instructions. With a bull from the herd for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. And he shall put on the holy linen coat and shall have the linen undergarment on his body. And he shall tie the linen sash around his waist and wear the linen turban. So lots of linen here. These are the holy garments. He shall bathe his body in water and then put them on. And he shall take from the congregation of the people of Israel two male goats for a sin offering and one ram for a burnt offering. Now, just a few observations here. Again, the main figure in the ritual is obviously the high priest, so that the rightness or the efficacy of the ritual, again, doing it correctly and not violating, not having a problem like you had in Leviticus 10 with Nadav and Avihu, all of that depended on the high priest. He has to bathe. He has to wear, again, a lot of linen, linen coat, linen turban, linen sash. Now, if you go back to Leviticus 8, and of course, back in Exodus, in the later chapters, 28, 29, around there, that's when we get a description of the normal clothing, the normal vestments of the high priest, which had lots of gold and jewels and lots of costly, you know, fabrics that were dyed different colors. Here, it's much simpler. It's just your linen. Just linens here. For this ritual, then, the high priest wears something a lot more simple, a lot sort of stripped down. A lot of the fanciness, if you will, is taken away from the high priest as he is about to enter, you know, into the most holy place and perform what needs to be done on this particular day, the Day of Atonement. So the implication is that these white, you know, these linen garments, again, it doesn't really give the color, but again, they're undyed, so something very plain. But the implication is that these linen garments are prepared for this occasion specifically. Simple, unadorned intercessor is the role of the high priest. He's stripped of all signs of status, just as simple as you can get. So the high priest, again, is the key person. He apparently goes to a specific location within the tent of meeting complex to take off his normal garments and change into the simple ones. That's based on verse 23, which is after the ritual when we get the comment, then Aaron shall come into the tent of meeting and shall take off the linen garments that he put on when he went into the holy place and shall leave them there. Apparently he gets redressed in his normal garb, you know, for when he's on sacred space. So again, it's just stripped of all signs of status. Aaron also has to provide a bull for the sin or the purification, the decontamination offering. His own bull, apparently from his own herd, because in verse 5, we get a reference to taking from the congregation two male goats for a sin offering and one ram. And that line is not back here in verse 3. So apparently this is something that Aaron, the high priest, and whoever was the high priest, has to take from his own herd for his own sin offering. Again, that makes sense. The community, of course, will provide two male goats and then a ram for their offerings. Again, the two goats, one of them. The reason why you have both goats referred to as a sin offering, a purification or decontamination offering, even though only one of them will end up being sacrificed. The reason for that is that the lots have not been cast yet over these two. So since we don't know yet, you know, which one's going to be the actual sin offering, they're both referred to that way. We don't know which one's going to be for the Lord, which one's going to be for Azazel. Again, we'll get to Azazel in a moment. At this point, either could be the sin offering. So that's, you know, why we have the language here. And of course, the burnt offering, you know, after the ritual's done, the burnt offering, if you remember back to our discussion of burnt offerings, this was, again, you know, visiting God's house to sort of, you know, establish a relationship with him. Again, once the sanctuary has been decontaminated, then, you know, the role of the burnt offering is there, again, to reestablish, reset, you know, a direct relationship with the God of Israel, that now Israel is accepted into my presence. They've been decontaminated. So sure, come on over, you know, come on over to Yahweh's house, you know, that sort of thing. So Leviticus 16:6, just continue on here. Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering for himself, and shall make atonement for himself and for his house, his household. Then he shall take the two goats and set them before the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And Aaron shall cast lots over the two goats, one lot for the Lord, and the other lot for Azazel. And Aaron shall present the goat on which the lot fell for the Lord, and use it as a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot fell for Azazel shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement over it. And I would say a better way to translate that would be to make expiation with it, or to make a purging with it, or to, you know, again, the whole notion of the sin offering, you know, is again decontamination, purification. But in the instance of this live goat, the idea again, falling back to atonement, has to do with the person, or in this case, it's representative for the whole congregation, for them to be purged of any, you know, sort of flaw or again contaminant, or if there's anything amiss, you know, that's marring the relationship between us and God. Well, those things, those issues, those sins, those problems, whatever you want to call it, those impurities will, at the end of verse 10, be sent away into the wilderness to Azazel. So this takes us into two issues here we need to discuss. Going back to Leviticus 4, the whole language of atonement. If you remember from that episode, the Hebrew kippur, with two P's there, kippur, really comes from the Akkadian verb kupuru, which means to wipe off or burnish or cleanse or purge, that kind of thing. Now, in cultic terms, again, in ritual terms, this meant that expiation was conceived of as a cleansing or wiping away of impurity, a getting rid of contamination. Now, we need to be a little more specific here. The point of that language, that verb in Akkadian and hence in Hebrew, is not that kippur, Hebrew kippur, refers to the action of wiping. Rather, it's more abstract. The term really refers to the fact that the person, in this case the whole people, have been purged or purified, again, in the sense that God looks upon what's being done in the ritual according to his command, and he responds in such a way to indicate that, well, now that you've done this, you're acceptable to me. You have been purged from anything that would mar our relationship. You are now fit for sacred space. So the point of the verb is not the wiping action, you know, not any activity, but rather the point is the result. You know, that you have been made acceptable now. You've been purged from impurity. Even more specifically, in the context of Leviticus 16, which is, you know, where we're camping here today, the goat for Azazel, again, the one that's not sacrificed, purges the people from impurity by removing the impurity out of the camp, away from sacred space, and into the wilderness, which is the domain of Azazel. And this harkens back to the whole concept of cosmic geography. Turf that is foreign to Yahweh's domain, Yahweh's presence, and in fact hostile to Yahweh's presence and Yahweh's domain. So this is where you put impurities. You drive them out. You remove them from sacred space to protect the sanctity of not only the tabernacle and its vessels and the place upon which it rests, but also the people. Again, this is a reset button for the nation in this ritual. Now, along with that, we can't understand this goat, which is never sacrificed, this goat which is sent out into the wilderness, because that's where Azazel is. This is not an offering to Azazel, again, because there's no ritual killing here. Rather, the goat is just a vehicle for the removal of impurity, so that you send impurity to where it belongs, to the realm in which it belongs. And that realm is where Yahweh is not. Yahweh is not associated with impurity. He is not associated with flaws and imperfections of any kind. His turf, his domain, and his people are holy. They are sanctified. And so impurity must be removed. So it's not like an offering like Azazel is being appeased, or anything like that. Actually, Azazel's getting a, you know, if I could be, I should probably shouldn't be so crude in the podcast, but I was going to say just a load of, you know what, CRAP, I guess. You know, that's what is happening here. We don't want impurities here. You're impure by definition because, you know, you're not Yahweh. So you take them. This is where they belong, that kind of thing. So it's not an appeasement. It's basically dumping what you don't want in the place where it belongs. Now, a lot of translations, again, don't read Azazel here. They have scapegoat. And I discussed this you know, in a fair amount of detail in the Unseen Realm. It's, for those who have the book, it's specifically pages 176 and 177. I'm going to read a few short excerpts from that for those who don't understand what in the world is this crazy man talking about, Azazel here. You know, my Bible doesn't say anything like that. Well, here's essentially why. So this is, again, from Unseen Realm. I wrote, the word Azazel in the Hebrew text, and that is what is in the Hebrew text. You know, for those who know Hebrew, it's Zion, Zion, Aleph, Zion, Lamed. Okay, that's what gets translated scapegoat, but it's Azazel more literally. The word Azazel in the Hebrew text can be translated, quote, the goat that goes away, unquote. Now that's the justification for the common scapegoat translation. So in other words, if you take those five consonants and separate them into Az and Azal, you have goat that goes away. And that's where scapegoat comes from. For instance, like in the NIV, NASB, King James, that sort of thing. The scapegoat, so those translations have it, symbolically carries the sins of the people away from the camp of Israel into the wilderness. And that seems simple enough. However, Azazel is really a proper name. In Leviticus 16:8, one goat, you'll notice, is for, preposition lamed in Hebrew, for Yahweh, while the other goat is for, preposition lamed, Azazel. Since Yahweh is a proper name and the goats are described in the same way, Hebrew parallelism informs us that Azazel should also be taken as a proper name. What needs resolution is what that all means. So again, the issue is the five consonants. You keep them together, it's a proper name. You separate them, then you have goat that goes away. Now, the whole goat that goes away idea, again, this is just me talking now. I'm not quoting anything here from the book. This whole idea could work if it wasn't for verse 26. And, you know, frankly, it could work, you know, if you sort of just wanted to close your eyes at cosmic geography and other, again, things in the unseen realm too. But let's just focus on verse 26. Verse 26 throws a wrench into the goat that goes away, because if you translate Azazel that way in verse 26, here's what you get. The verse would say literally, he who lets the goat go to the goat that goes away. Now, how does that make any sense? He who lets the goat go to the goat that goes away. It's much clearer if you translate he who lets the goat go to Azazel. Again, honoring the parallelism earlier in the chapter of Yahweh and Azazel. So it's clear from verse 26 and, you know, again, the phrases for Azazel and for Yahweh that a proper name is needed here, because it just turns verse 26 into gibberish. Again, if you're counting for all the Hebrew in the actual text, it just turns it into gibberish if you opt for the scapegoat idea. I mean, and you know, translations cheat here all the time, but you know, we try not to cheat. Back to Unseen Realm, I made this comment. Azazel is regarded as the name of a demon in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Again, because it's an entity, it's a proper name. And also other ancient Jewish books. In fact, in one scroll, 4Q180, that's a Dead Sea Scroll, column 1, line 8, Azazel is the leader of the angels that sinned in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. Again, that's Jewish tradition. We don't have anything biblical to establish that, but it shows you what they were thinking. This is a hostile entity. It's just a bad guy, a demonic figure. The same description appears in the book of 1 Enoch. Again, Azazel shows up in Enoch as the name of, you know, a leader of, you know, the angels that sinned, the watchers in Genesis 6. Again, this is, you know, sort of, I don't want to go back too far into this, but if you read, you know, the book and you sort of have an understanding of where demons come from in all of, you know, Jewish tradition and Jewish theology, the origin of demons is intimately tied to the fallout of what happens in Genesis 6, 1 through 4, with the Nephilim as well. So it's very understandable why you'd have certain Dead Sea Scrolls that link Azazel, again, a demonic figure that now is sort of roaming the earth, because that's what the demons do according to Enoch when they're disembodied. The demons are the result of, you know, killing a Nephilim. So the disembodied spirit of a Nephilim, that's what the demons are. So it's very natural to sort of identify one of these with, you know, the whole incident back in Genesis 6, and that's what's happening in 4Q180. And that's not the only place either, but in that text you specifically have Azazel mentioned. What it tells us, again, we can't, and there's nothing, you know, really biblical that you can piece together to get that whole, you know, that whole thought trajectory other than the origin of demons. I would argue that does have hooks back into the biblical text, where demons come from. But as far as the more specific details here, we may not have that, but it shows what people are thinking. It shows that people are looking back at Azazel. You know, Jews are looking at this term in Leviticus 8, and they're thinking entity. They're thinking demon. They're not thinking scapegoat in the way that some of our English translations handle it. They're thinking something much different. And again, I think properly so. So let's go back to Leviticus 16 here. The purification of the sanctuary happens in verse 11. So like what happens with all the goats and everything like this? Well, verse 11 picks up and says, Aaron shall present the bull as a sin offering for himself, again, and make an atonement for himself. Again, he make a purging and for his house, and he shall kill the bull as a sin offering for himself. And he shall take a censer full of the coals of fire from the altar before the Lord, and two handfuls of sweet incense beaten small. And he shall bring it inside the veil and put the incense on the fire before the Lord. That's the altar of incense that's right there at the veil, within the tabernacle. So that, verse 13, so that the cloud of the incense may cover the mercy seat that is over the testimony, so that he does not die. So the incense sort of creates this barrier, a visual barrier between Aaron and the presence of God at the mercy seat. Verse 14, and he, Aaron, shall take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the front of the mercy seat. On the east side, on the front of the mercy seat, he shall sprinkle some of the blood with his finger seven times. Then he shall kill the goat of the sin offering that is for the people and bring its blood inside the veil of the mercy seat. Thus he shall make atonement for the holy place. Notice that. Thus he shall make atonement for the holy place, the sanctuary, because of the uncleanness of the people of Israel and because of their transgressions, all their sins. And he shall do for the tent of meeting which dwells with them in the midst of their uncleanness. No one may be in the tent of meeting from the time he enters to make atonement for the holy place until he comes out and has made atonement for himself and for his house and for all the assembly of Israel. Then he shall go out to the altar that is before the Lord and make atonement for it. So now the altar is atoned for. And he shall take some of the blood of the bull and some of the blood of the goats and put it on the horns of the altar all around. And he shall sprinkle some of the blood on it with his finger seven times and cleanse it and consecrate it from the uncleanness of the people of Israel. So that's 11 through 19, a few observations here. Again, we're not told who helps Aaron, but he had to have assistance for some of these functions because you can't like be killing the bull and holding the censer and doing the incense thing all at the same time. So apparently there's somebody, you know, with him helping him in out, but he is the one that is responsible for all of the ritual acts here to be done properly. And then that other person, indicated here, the other person is going to have to either leave or, you know, maybe some of this was prepared beforehand and you know, Aaron puts it on a tape. We don't know, but I mean, he's only got two arms. So there's an issue there, or at least something that we don't often think about. But any assistance he had or any procedural thing he did to help himself out isn't really mentioned here. Mercy seat, I should say a few things about this. This is a common translation. Again, I'm reading the ESV. This is not a good translation, although it's a traditional one. The reason it gets translated mercy seat is that we have here a noun, kaporet, formed from the same lemma, it's formed from a lemma that is related to the verb kiper. So kiper and kaporet, they both have the kaf and then the double P, K, and two P's. One's a noun, one's a verb. So the verb for atonement, kiper, this is sort of a noun equivalent in Hebrew, kaporet. And so since the verb gets this atonement language associated with it, so the noun is referred to as the mercy seat because this is the result of the atonement. God is showing mercy. And that is an abstracted interpretive translation. More literally, if atonement, the verb kiper, means to purge, okay, then kaporet should be the place of purging. In other words, it would really focus on the location, not the result. Again, because calling it the mercy seat is sort of reading the theological result into the lemma. And that's why it's not a great translation. There are other reasons too. Let me just quote you something from Nahum Sarna's commentary on Exodus when the ark is being built, you know, with the lid. He says here, mercy seat is in the English versions. This is based on the Septuagint and Vulgate translations, which mean instrument of propitiation. Again, getting it from this lemma relationship. It follows the usual sense of the Hebrew stem KPR, to atone or make expiation. And this understanding would appear to be strengthened by the instruction in Leviticus 16:15 and 16, that at this spot, in the Holy of Holies, the high priest is to perform expiatory rites on the Day of Atonement. Again, and what I'm saying is the focus should be on the location, not on the theological result, as far as the translation goes. But Sarna makes another comment here. He says, nevertheless, mercy seat is not a satisfactory translation of kaporet, since the aspect of mercy is an interpretation and is not inherent in the word. Again, that's just what I was saying. The translation, a cover. Okay, some translations will have covering or cover for kaporet instead of mercy seat. He says, Sarna says, the translation a cover rests again on a supposed primary meaning to cover for the Hebrew verb kiper, which again is not the case. Kiper comes from Akkadian kuporu, which is about purging. It's not about covering anything. It's about purging. So again, these are English options that really are not satisfactory. And think about it. I mean, just think about what this object is. The kaporet is the lid of the ark. It is actually God's seat throne, since the ark is elsewhere described as God's footstool. For instance, 1 Chronicles 28:2, Psalm 99:5, Psalm 132:7. I'll just read, you know, one or two of these. Psalm 99:5 says, "Exalt the Lord our God, worship at his footstool. Holy is he." 1 Chronicles 28:2, King David rose to his feet and said, "Hear me, my brothers and my people. I had it in my heart to build a house of rest for the ark of the covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God, and I made preparations for the building." Again, the ark associated with this idea of being a footstool. Lamentations 2:1, another instance. So the lid that goes over the ark, the kaporet, which is placed atop the aron, that's the Hebrew word for ark, is actually God's seat throne, and the ark is his footstool. So the imagery is that God is sitting on this golden slab, this is solid gold, also atop of which are fixed two cherubim. So it's a cherubim throne. The lid, the kaporet, is a cherubim throne. The ark is underneath, again, where God's feet rest. Again, that's the imagery. Sarna comments on a little bit on the cherubim. He says, at either end of the kaporet, a cherub was hammered out. The two cherubim faced each other with their heads bent slightly downward. Their fully outstretched wings were turned upward, sheltering the main body of the lid and the ark below it. Verse 22, as well as Numbers 7:89, make clear that the divine voice was thought to issue from the space above the lid and between the two cherubim. And if we take the theophanic language that began this chapter, Leviticus 16:2, where God says, "I will appear in the cloud," then, you know, you actually could have a visible form of an enthroned deity, the enthroned Yahweh, at the kaporet, because it was his seat throne. Continuing or going back to Sarna, Sarna says, you know, this makes clear again that the kaporet with its cherubim would support the invisible throne of God. It explains a frequently employed epithet of God as the one who, quote, is enthroned between the cherubim. Okay, various verses, you know, use that language. 1 Samuel 4:4, 2 Samuel 6:2, so on and so forth. The imagery of the footstool and the throne evoke the conception of, again, this, how obvious is this? This imagery, footstool and throne, evoke the conception of God as king. Now, we don't often think of Leviticus 16 as a scene, a throne room scene, but that's what it is. It's God as king, again, enthroned on the cherubim. You know, those of you who have followed my blog and even the Paleo Babel blog, when I talk about throne iconography, and in Unseen Realm, we get into throne iconography. Very clear examples that this was a familiar idea, because cherubim, again, just as kiper comes from Akkadian kuporu, cherub, karuv, comes from an Akkadian term as well, and it refers to a throne guardian. Okay, so again, it's just throne imagery left and right, but we often don't think about that when we're reading through Leviticus 16 because we have translations like mercy seat. That doesn't really conjure up any sort of throne imagery at all. I mean, frankly, neither does lid, neither does cover, neither does place of purging. You know, if you wanted to take kaporet and be very literal with it. I mean, I actually think a really good translation here would be throne, you know, seat throne or something like that, because conceptually, that's what it is. Now, that wouldn't be a good translation in terms of, you know, literalism, things that are wrapped up in the lemma, but it captures the point of the description, you know, that's going on here and elsewhere. Yeah, we can talk about translation philosophy some other point. So in verse 13, again, we have the phrase that this is how you approach it. You put the incense up there. You got God, you know, sitting on his seat throne right here. You do it this way with the incense cloud. You got to get that going first, you know, burning because, you know, we don't want the high priest to die in verse 13. Again, and then we get into in verses 16, 18, 19, what happens with the blood? Well, the blood is brought into the Holy of Holies and it's sprinkled again on the throne seat. It's, you know, applied, you know, thereafter to the horns of the altar. Again, the language is, he shall make atonement for the holy place. He shall make atonement for the altar. In other words, he shall purge, you know, the lid of the ark, you know, the throne seat. He shall purge the altar. He shall purge the holy place. Thus shall you purge or decontaminate the holy place and its objects. You know, this is not about forgiveness of moral wrongs because, frankly, objects don't commit sins. It's talking about decontamination and purging of impurity. Verse 19 adds that you cleanse it, you consecrate it from the uncleanness of the people of Israel. In other words, this is where impurity is going to arise from the people, you know, either the people who administer, you know, who conduct business, you know, inside of the holy place according to God's command. They're going to have contact with the masses, so to speak, and one of them might be unclean. I mean, there's this constant threat of impurity and uncleanness. Again, ritual impurity being brought into sacred space. And so that's why once a year, we got to just sort of take care of business here in a reset kind of way. Bring everything back to its original state. If we go to verse 20, that's not all. When he, the high priest, has made an end of atoning for the holy place, and the tent of meeting, and the altar, he shall present the live goat. This is the one for Azazel. Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the iniquities of the people of Israel, all their transgressions, all their sins. Again, here's where you pick up the idea of moral problem, moral impurity. But this is the goat that isn't sacrificed. Again, this is the goat for Azazel. It's not the goat for Yahweh. The goat for Yahweh is dedicated to purging and protecting sacred space and sacred objects from impurity. This is the goat over which all the iniquities of the people of Israel, their transgressions, their sins are confessed, and he, the high priest, shall put them on the head of the goat, again, a symbolic act of transfer to the goat, and send the goat away into the wilderness by the hand of a man who is in readiness. The goat shall bear all their iniquities on itself to a remote area, and he shall let the goat go free into the wilderness. So again, sin is expunged. It is driven from sacred space. It is driven from the presence of God. Now again, back to the unseen realm. I'll quote another little selection here. Recall that in intertestamental Judaism, the offending sons of God from Genesis 6 were believed to have been imprisoned in a pit or abyss in the netherworld, which is called Eretz, you know, in some texts, which is the same word for the ground, you know, for earth. Azazel's realm was somewhere out there in the desert, either associated with geography, dirt, you know, land that is not occupied by the presence of Yahweh. There's where Yahweh is and his presence, his people, and then there's everything else. Or again, this conception of the underworld, you know, being under the earth, that sort of thing. So you get these ideas, you know, that sort of glom onto each other here. So it's non-holy ground. The wilderness is non-holy ground, non-sacred space, and frankly, space that is hostile to where Yahweh and his people are. It was a place associated with supernatural evil. Now, the Old Testament itself, again, doesn't state that Azazel was a demon. Scholars have, however, connected the name to Mot, the god of death. This is from the unseen realm. And Mot, of course, is an underworld deity. It's the god of death, the underworld, the dead. That's two peas in a pod there. The identification of the term with a demon may also derive from cosmic geography and an association of the wilderness with the forces of chaos, which of course are hostile to God. This would make sense on several levels, as the desert would not only be a place forbidding to life, but as ground outside the camp of Israel, and of course the presence of Yahweh, the source of life. The wilderness would have been a clear association with the forces of chaos. It was threatening. It was dangerous. Leviticus 17:7 also suggests, again, we'll get into Leviticus 17 in another episode, but just this one comment. That passage also suggests that Israelites saw the desert as spiritually sinister. Leviticus 17:7 says, "So they shall no more sacrifice their sacrifices to goat demons, after whom they whore." That's ESV. So we're not told why the Israelites, at least some Israelites, had done this. But the placement of this problem in proximity to the ritual goat to Azazel suggests a conceptual connection. Jews of later periods certainly made such a connection. In other words, they were scared. They were scared of the outside world, you know, the wilderness realm, because it was a place associated with death, with moat, with the underworld, with hostile spiritual forces, all this stuff. And so apparently Leviticus 17:7 alludes to the fact that some Israelites were like, they were freaked out and they're sacrificing, you know, to keep the bad guys at bay. And so Leviticus says, you're not going to do this anymore. Again, this is not something that we do now. You know, we're you know, once a year we're going to send our sins, you know, on the goat that remains alive to Azazel, you know, get rid of them, send them where they belong, that sort of thing. But they were, again, it just tells you how they were thinking about sacred space devoted to Yahweh and, of course, to them if they're in communion with Yahweh, and then basically everything else, especially the wilderness. Again, it just had these negative, sinister associations attached to it. And you see wilderness imagery in lots of passages in the Old Testament, especially associated with this idea. Of course, you get it in the New Testament. Where does Jesus encounter the devil? Well, where else would you encounter him? In the wilderness, in the desert. I mean, that's normal. You know, that kind of thinking, that kind of theology, that kind of cosmic geography is present in the New Testament as well. Now, I have a note here in the unseen realm after that, the short paragraph about Leviticus 17:7 that alludes to J.B. Lightfoot noting that the Jewish practice later on in Jewish history about the goat for Azazel was to push the goat over a cliff to ensure that it never found its way back to holy ground. And if you want to read that, you can look it up on Unseen Realm. But it's just kind of interesting that, again, they took it that far. Again, they were scared that the goat would find its way back and bring the impurities back and who knows what else with it. So they would drive it over a cliff. Lastly here, five more verses in Leviticus 16 and we'll wrap up. In verse 29, I'm not going to read the whole rest of the chapter, but these five verses here we will. "It shall be a statute," you know, all of this, verse 29, "shall be a statute to you forever, that in the seventh month, in the seventh day of the month, you shall afflict yourselves and shall do no work, either the native or the stranger who sojourns among you. For on this day shall atonement be made, shall purging be made for you to cleanse you." Again, purging both in terms of the sanctuary and driving all impurities outside of the camp. "So this day shall be made for you to cleanse you. You shall be clean before the Lord from all your sins." Verse 31, "It is a Sabbath of solemn rest to you." In other words, you're not going to work on this day either. "And you shall afflict yourselves. It is a statute forever. And the priest who is anointed and consecrated as priest in his father's place shall make atonement wearing the holy linen garments. He shall make atonement for the holy sanctuary, and he shall make atonement for the tent of meeting and for the altar and make atonement for the priests and all the people of the assembly," basically everybody and everything. Again, this is a reset. "And this shall be a statute forever for you, that atonement may be made for the people of Israel once in the year because of all their sins. And Aaron did as the Lord commanded Moses." Again, everything, every person, every object, the entirety of sacred space is restored back to the condition that it was initially put in when all of it originated, when the whole system was set up. That very first day back in Leviticus 8, when the tabernacle and everything was sanctified so that now it could be used. Now we can, you know, we can do what needs to be done here. That's the purpose of Leviticus 16. And just some points for us. Again, I think trying to summarize some of the things that I've said a few minutes ago, I think it's really helpful to think of Leviticus 16 in light of the imagery of God as king. And he is the one who actually, it's not the high priest, he is the one who actually brings about the purging and the atonement by providing and accepting the ritual. The matter of impurity has to be brought directly to his throne for his decision. That is where the ritual application of the blood begins. And it is the throne. It is the seat throne of God. It's not just a lid. It's not just a cover. Mercy seat, again, misses the point. Throne. I think throne is the best way to process what in the Israelite mind was happening here. The priest is stripped of all forms of status. He has to go in representing the people to the very throne of the king, who he hopes will accept, again, the ritual acts so that everything can be restored to a pristine spiritual condition as it was, again, when it all started. And I just think the imagery is helpful. Secondly, while people, again, the result is that people are reset, they're purged. The blood is never applied to them. They are purged by virtue of the fact that God, the king, accepts the sacrifice. In other words, it's the grace of God. Okay, the blood's never applied to them. They are never sanctified by blood in the ritual. The holy space, sacred space is sanctified, and then their sins are carried away. But God has to accept the point, again, of the application of the blood and even the sending of the way of the goat to Azazel. It's up to God. It's up to God to do this, to accept that, okay, you've done this in good faith. You've been obedient. You've tried to, honor me, for who I am. You've given me my proper place. You're obeying me because you believe I'm the God of gods and so on and so forth. And then, God's good. God's good with that. We're all good for another year, or at least, you're supposed to be, enacting these rituals whenever impurity comes up, but we're good. We're reset. We're back to the beginning again. Thirdly, the goat for Yahweh, again, is the blood issue. The blood goat for Azazel is the removal of impurity. Both goats factor into the representation of how the New Testament describes salvation. In other words, when the New Testament talks about salvation, we are both made fit for God's presence. That's the purging part. And our impurities, our sins, as it were, are removed. Again, that's the other goat, the living goat part. So both sides of this ritual coin, as it were, are sort of merged in the way the New Testament talks about salvation. So I think those three thoughts, again, and again, trying to see the throne room of God here in this ritual, I think is a good way for us to process it and use this chapter to help us think about the enthroned Christ and what happens on the cross. Again, especially the way that the New Testament, think of the irony, especially the way the New Testament talks about the cross as enthronement. Okay, when Jesus, was offered as a sacrifice to sin, then, he winds up, because he does that, at the right hand of God, enthroned at the right hand of God. I mean, all this enthronement talk that is associated with the crucifixion. Again, I think that creates a good conceptual link back to Leviticus 16 that we can appreciate and process.
Mike, I noticed on your blog you mentioned something about John Walton's article. I didn't know if you wanted to mention something about that, or.
Yeah, I'm wondering. There's a good article that Walton breaks down Leviticus, the whole book, into sort of parallel zones of, I'm trying to remember the exact term he uses, equilibrium. The sort of like restoring equilibrium in a very cosmic sense, and how the book of Leviticus is laid out to sort of reinforce that idea. I think, and you'll mention it, or you probably saw in the blog, I have been toying with the idea of referencing that article either here or at the end of our time in Leviticus. I'm still not sure what I want to do there. We probably could post it. I can send it to you, Trey, because we can always bring it up later too and post it at the last episode, I guess. But, okay. There's no harm in doing it early here. But it's a really interesting article, and Leviticus 16 is a good place for it because, as Walton points out, Leviticus 16 is sort of a hinge point in how the book is laid out. So that's why I was thinking about doing it here or at the end, when you can sort of step back and look at the whole picture. But we can do it at both. So I'll send you that, and you could append that article to this episode too.
Okay, sounds good. Well, you're back from the conferences, so how did it go?
Yep, it went well. I mean, it's very busy. You can literally be going from morning till very late at night just talking to people, but it's great, to run into people you only see once a year. And I actually made a point, to go, hear a number of papers. I'll probably blog, I just don't know when I'll do it, but maybe the next week or so I will blog a list of the papers that I heard that I thought were interesting, and sort of just summarize what the point of it was and what the takeaway was. But yeah, it went well.
And did you have any reaction from the Unseen Realm at the conferences?
Yeah, I did. A lot of people brought it up, actually. I had Bob Chisholm at Dallas, who was the guy who helped shepherd my first article, Deuteronomy 32:8 and the Sons of God. He helped shepherd that thing through Dallas's journal process, again, because he's an Old Testament guy. He gets the Sons of God kind of thing. And I ran into him at a session, and he said he was hoping to use the book in it as a required book in one of his classes. There's already been somebody who's done that. Gary Yates at Liberty has used it in a class, and there were a couple of others that just said, "Yeah, we're going to fit this in somewhere in our Old Testament classes or our theology class or something like that." So I probably had maybe a dozen people say something about the book, you know, all positive during the course of the conference
and the podcast too.
Yeah, and the podcast. That there were a number of people who, you know, brought up the podcast who knew about it and were pretty regular listeners, you know. And again, I associate, you know, the podcast with again something we do to produce content, you know, for people outside the guild. But here we have people in the guild, you know, who are actually paying attention to the thing. So that was kind of nice to hear.
Yeah, that's awesome. You also did an Atlanta Unseen Realm event. How'd that go?
Yeah, that went really well. You know, shout out to Tim Andrews, who, again, a layperson, heard about that I was willing to travel and took it upon himself to organize a meeting because he again, learned from the blog that I was going to be in Atlanta. And so we worked a Saturday night out during the conference week. I put that time aside to go over and do that. I would think 50 people, you know, 50, maybe a little bit more. I didn't do a head count, but the place was full. I think we would have at least had 50. That it met in a building that's actually was a remodeled funeral home that is used by a pretty large and enduring, you know, this is something that's been going on for years, a house church community that they've essentially outgrown the houses, the homes that they can meet in without getting in trouble with zoning and whatnot. So they actually have a building and it's not marked as a church, but they use it to meet. And there were a lot of people with the book. I spent an hour signing books at this event. And just talking to people. You know, we did a couple hours just talking about points in the book, you know, major, you know, sort of the flyover kind of topics, then an hour of Q&A, and then another hour just signing books and chatting with people, you know, who came. So it was quite a good event.
Yeah, and get a lot of good feedback about the book and the
show.
And
yeah, just people appreciating the podcast and, of course, you know, the book content. But again, on that community, there were a significant number that mentioned the podcast, that they're really benefiting from it. There was one guy at the conference, if we can mentally go back to the conference, who uses the podcast for a small group situation where he lives, and they're planning to go through Supernatural in a small group. So, I mean, people are using the content, which is surprise, surprise. I mean, that's why we do it. I want, you know, to produce content that people actually find useful. So it was a good week. It was very busy, kind of exhausting, but a really good week.
Well, speaking about using the content as a group, don't you have an update about the leader's guide for the Supernatural?
Yeah. Yeah. There is a leader's guide written by Ron Johnson, and Ron, was with me at the Atlanta event, and we, you know, we hung out, you know, during the week as well. Ron, again, has been interviewed on the Naked Bible podcast, and he's the guy who produced the Leader's Guide for Supernatural. That is available now in digital form, in the Logos format. So you could get it that way. It's going to be in paperback shortly. That may happen by the end of the year. I'm not quite sure as far as a date. But for people who wanted to get a digital version, that is obtainable right now. So that's what I told, again, the person who wanted to be able to use the go through the book. You know, he just wanted to have a leader's guide as well in case, you know, that there was something in there that, and there is, you know, illustrations and things like that. He wanted that as well. So it's not secret knowledge. It just hasn't been publicized, you know, a whole lot. But it's available in digital right now.
Well, we'll be looking for that. And next week, we're going to have part one of all the interviews you did while you're at the conferences.
Yeah, I took a recorder with me during the conference week. And scholars that I just ran into, you know, that you know, after a paper or while we're trolling the book aisles, that kind of thing, I'd stop and say, hey, can you give me 3 or 4 minutes? And who are you? Introduce yourself. Why do you come to the academic meetings? You know, what do you get out of it? If they've heard any good papers, if they gave any papers, you know, just sort of a summary on who they are and what they're doing, you know, that week at the conferences.
And we're going to have 2 parts. So next week, part 1. Mike, is there anything else you'd like to discuss for the show?
No, I think that's it.
Okay, well, great. I just want to thank you for doing Leviticus and thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.